Hello, ahlan wa sahlan, and welcome to another episode of Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show that airs on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. During this episode of Arab Voices, episode number 1187, I will have three segments. First, we will listen to the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, highlighting the Israeli genocide and catastrophic situation in the Gaza Strip. During the second segment, I will air some of the remarks delivered at the National March for Palestine, held in London, attended by nearly 600,000 people. I will air the remarks of Ben Jamal, Director of Palestine Solidarity Campaign, Jeremy Corbyn, Member of the British Parliament, and Denise Goff, an Irish actress who just returned from the occupied West Bank. During the third segment, I will air the remarks of Professor Noura Ariqat, a Palestinian-American human rights attorney and author, delivered at the United Nations Security Council Open Debate on Women, Peace and Security, addressing how Israel's ongoing Nakba in Gaza intends to destroy the Palestinian people in violation of the Geneva Convention, and detailing how attacks on the reproductive capacity of Palestinian women and girls collectively aim to eliminate the possibility of a Palestinian future in four stages. Let's begin with the Electronic Intifada newscast, a summary of the latest developments in occupied Palestine, highlighting the Israeli genocide and catastrophic situation in the Gaza Strip, presented by Noura Barros-Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Noura Barros-Friedman, Associate Editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 741 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. On October 10th, the U.S. brokered third ceasefire came into effect following 2 years and 3 days of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Journalist Ayman Al-Hissi documented thousands of Palestinians once again returning to their homes in Gaza City and the north, many of whom were forcibly displaced by Israel over the last few weeks. Mahmoud Bassal, spokesperson for the civil defense, was greeted by reporter Saeed Hezbollah and passersby in the early hours of the announcement of a truce on October 9th, as Palestinians expected the bombing to stop. Bassal said, smiling broadly, quote, "This is the moment we've been waiting for 2 years, 2 years of our people being exterminated, 2 years of our people being murdered. Today, Gaza is liberated from this occupation. Today, a ceasefire is declared. Congratulations to our people. Congratulations to every child in Gaza." An older man tells Saeed, quote, "We congratulate you on your steadfastness and the steadfastness of the Palestinian people on this beloved land." Another man adds, quote, "Gaza has proven throughout the ages that it is resistant to aggression. Gaza is the symbol of legendary patience. We stayed in Gaza. We will not leave Gaza and will not allow any occupier or colonizer to kill this country." However, later that night on October 9th, just hours after people celebrated and tried to return home, Israeli forces bombed a building in the center of Gaza City, killing at least six and wounding many others, with more trapped under the rubble. Saeed Hezbollah again reported from the scene, showing civil defense crews trying to reach the dead and wounded. The spokesperson for the Gaza municipality, our contributor Asim Al-Nabih, spoke to Middle East Eye on October 9th as the Israeli army was still attacking areas across Gaza.
Tell us how news of the ceasefire has been received in Gaza today.
To be honest, there is no ceasefire yet in the city. In the past 20 minutes, there were more than five explosions. I counted myself. I'm sure there is other explosions in other neighborhoods. We can't say that there is a calmness in the city while many people around the world circulating the news about ceasefire. The people in Gaza are still suffering from different and difficult circumstances in terms of bombardment, in terms of food insecurity, in terms of water scarcity, in terms of massive destruction in the infrastructure and civic facilities. Today, after 2 years of genocidal war in Gaza, there is a water scarcity. Can you imagine that there is more than 75% of the total water wells in Gaza have been destroyed, and people now are getting less than 25% of the total daily needs of water.
On October 10th, as the ceasefire was finally implemented, Palestinians continued to return to the north. Journalist Abdelkader Sabah filmed footage for Dropsite News, saying, quote, "People are returning to Gaza City any way they can, on foot, by motorized rickshaw, by truck, but the level of destruction is difficult to explain. Sheikh Radwan is destroyed, so is Tal al-Hawa, Nafaq Street. Many neighborhoods are ruined, but some features of life are returning." Journalist Bisan Auda documented the wreckage Israel left behind in the ruins of the Zeytun neighborhood of Gaza City on October 11th.
This is Bisan from Gaza. Today I'm documenting a new neighborhood that was destroyed in the past 2 to 3 weeks. And it's around the Zeytun neighborhood in Gaza City. And this is the explosive vehicle, or what the Palestinians call robot, explosive robot. It's a booby-trapped also. This is a vehicle that the Israelis used to put about 10 to 15 times a day during the past 2 months. These used to be vehicles to carry the soldiers, by the way, as you see. But during the genocide, the Israelis used it to put explosive material inside and then to put them in the middle of the neighborhoods. As you see, nothing is standing until about 200 meters. And then after that, the damage starts. But all of these homes were shaken.
Bisan Auda. Over the weekend, as they had agreed to do under the ceasefire terms, Palestinian resistance factions handed over all living Israeli captives to the International Committee of the Red Cross and began locating and preparing to transfer the bodies of dead Israeli captives as well. Israel began releasing living Palestinian hostages from Israeli prisons and detention camps who returned to Gaza in severe health crises, testifying to unbearable torture, sexual assault, and sadistic humiliation at the hands of Israeli guards. Photojournalist Shadi Abu Sido, who was kidnapped on March 18, 2024, during the Israeli occupation's raid on Al-Shifa Hospital in Gaza City, spoke about his 20 months of Israeli torture. He says, quote, "For 2 years, I was starved. I went in starving and came out starving. They hung our bodies day and night, naked, abused and insulted us. They told us, 'We killed your children. Gaza is gone.'" Another freed hostage, 28-year-old Mahmoud Abu Ful, said he was brutally beaten and tortured after being abducted from Kamel Adwan Hospital in December 2024. Abu Ful says that Israeli forces beat him so severely in the head during interrogations that he lost his ability to see. During the siege on Kamel Adwan Hospital on December 27, 2024, the Israeli army kidnapped everyone inside, including Abu Ful, and, of course, the hospital's director, Dr. Hossam Abu Safiya, who remains in detention despite indications earlier this week that he would be freed under the ceasefire terms. Earlier today, on Thursday, an Israeli court rubber-stamped the extension of Dr. Abu Safiya's arbitrary detention for 6 more months, according to Al-Mizan Center for Human Rights. No charges or evidence have been presented against him, making his detention illegal and politically motivated. Al-Mizan added that, quote, "This decision strips away any pretense. Dr. Abu Safiya is a hostage, a bargaining chip in ongoing negotiations." Over the past few days, Israeli forces also transferred dozens of dead bodies it had been holding to Gaza without any identifying information. Palestinian medical sources said that all 45 of the Palestinian bodies handed over by Israeli forces on Tuesday were blindfolded and handcuffed, indicating that field executions may have taken place. Reporter Adli Abutaha captured footage of bodies being returned to Gaza on Wednesday. In addition, track marks were found on some of the bodies, suggesting that they may have been run over by Israeli tanks. Israel had complained that not all of the bodies of its dead captives had been handed over on Tuesday, and announced that it had begun a policy of collective punishment by restricting the amount of humanitarian aid it would allow into Gaza and refusing to open the Rafah crossing at the Egyptian border. Palestinian political officials had long emphasized that it would take time and heavy machinery to locate the bodies, since Israel has completely destroyed the areas where bodies had been buried and has still refused to allow in any vehicles to remove the rubble. On Wednesday, the Qassam Brigades, the armed wing of Hamas, issued a statement saying that the group has met its commitments under the plan as it pertains to Israeli captives in Gaza. Quote, the resistance has adhered to what was agreed upon and has handed over all the living prisoners it can and the bodies it can access, the statement read. As for the remaining bodies, they require significant efforts and special equipment to search for and retrieve them, and we are making great efforts to close this file, they said. Israel's attacks on Palestinians have not stopped. On Tuesday, October 14th, Israel killed at least 9 Palestinians, including 5 in the Shujaiya neighborhood of eastern Gaza City. Palestinians were injured by Israeli fire in Jabalia, also in northern Gaza, on Tuesday, according to Gaza Emergency Services. Israeli army attacks in Khan Yunis killed at least 1 Palestinian and injured another. And medical sources stated that 3 Palestinians were killed on Wednesday, including 2 who were killed in another attack on Shujaiya. 4 Palestinians were killed on Thursday, according to the health ministry in Gaza, bringing the total number of people killed by Israel since the ceasefire began to at least 23. Meanwhile, you'll remember that last week we brought you several separate clips showing the 27-year-old journalist Saleh Al-Jafarawi celebrating the truce, walking through the streets late at night, announcing the ceasefire to residents who didn't receive the news yet, and coming home to his beloved cat. He uploaded this clip on October 9th, surrounded by his colleagues and vowing to continue the coverage even if the genocide continues. On Sunday, October 12th, Saleh was killed, reportedly by armed gangs who have been collaborating with Israel in Gaza City, as he was documenting the first days of the ceasefire and the extent of destruction that Israeli forces left behind. He had been hunted by Israel during the last 2 years of the genocide, and had buried many friends and colleagues who were murdered in assassinations by the Israeli army. His brother, Naji, was released from detention in Israel just hours after Saleh was buried by his relatives and loved ones. Naji told reporters that he was tortured and beaten and comforted Saleh's mourning friends, including reporter Ahmed Kahil. Naji tells Ahmed, quote, "You are all our brothers after Saleh. May we be able to fill his shoes for you. Saleh has fulfilled what he has presented." Saleh Al-Jafarawi was not only a dedicated journalist, he was also a talented singer. Last year, he sang a song called "Where Are You, O Humanity?" along with his friends and colleagues. It was recorded by journalist and poet Muhammad Al-Sha'ir. أبي يا غزة اسمعي يا علي ما تخضعي إلا لربك ترتعي معنا ولا إنسانا. Exactly 2 years to the day before his murder, Saleh Al-Jafarawi, in a viral clip on social media, was filmed comforting an infant in the first week of Israel's genocide on October 12th, 2023. Kuchi According to the Gaza government media office, Saleh was the 255th reporter and media worker to be killed in Gaza since October 2023. As of Wednesday, the Israeli army was continuing to restrict the amount of humanitarian aid, including food and basic supplies, into Gaza, in another clear violation of the terms of the ceasefire agreement. Al Jazeera's Tarek Abu Azoum said that only a trickle of aid is reaching Gaza, including only 12 World Food Program trucks that entered the central areas. Under the agreement, at least 600 trucks daily are mandated to enter. Euromed Human Rights Monitor stated on Tuesday that, quote, the risk of famine and malnutrition and their devastating consequences remains present in the Gaza Strip despite the entry into force of the ceasefire agreement. The limited quantities of goods and aid allowed into Gaza represent only a fraction of actual needs and fall far short of addressing the severe food and supply deficit that Israel has deliberately imposed as a tool of genocide during 2 years of military assault and comprehensive blockade. The rights group added that its field monitors reported that Israel permitted the entry of only 173 aid trucks since the ceasefire began on October 10th, with limited quantities of fuel and cooking gas, food, supplies, and some medical items. No aid trucks were allowed to enter on Monday under the pretext of releasing Palestinian detainees, nor on Tuesday due to Jewish holidays, both in blatant violation of the ceasefire agreement, Euromed said. Quote, Israel's control over the volume of aid, its non-compliance with the ceasefire terms, and its move toward further reductions not only constitute a breach of the agreement, but also amount to the continuation of genocide by depriving civilians of their basic rights, chief among them food, water, and medicine, and by imposing life-threatening conditions. This ongoing policy demonstrates Israel's determination to use starvation as a central instrument in its strategy to destroy Palestinian society in Gaza. The rights group noted that the entry of humanitarian aid into Gaza, quote, is not a privilege granted by Israel, but a binding legal obligation under international humanitarian law, guaranteeing civilians in wartime an absolute right to receive such assistance, and that, quote, any attempt to link food or medicine to political or security conditions constitutes a flagrant violation of fundamental rights, including the right to life, dignity, personal safety, health, food, and water. Meanwhile, the sites used by the joint U.S.-Israeli private killing fields masquerading as the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation were dismantled this week. Tarek Abu Azoum reported from one of the sites near the Netzarim corridor on October 11th.
Behind me, you can see a barren landscape, which is quite empty at the moment. It used to be the main aid center run by the controversial Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. It's located very close, as you can see, to Netzarim Corridor. And this aid hub has been meant to provide aid services for at least 300,000 Palestinians. We can see now the landscape has quite changed under the current terms of the ceasefire agreement. The foundation itself has dismantled the site here in order to completely deliver the responsibility of delivering aid supplies to the United Nations and its affiliated agencies. And once we were touring here, we found the remnants of the Israeli military munition that used to attack Palestinians who were seeking aid in the site. We can see right now the remnants of sound grenades and few bullets that have been used to shoot people who were trying to reach the site to getting aid. And if you can see there at the other end, people are still moving throughout Salah al-Din Road. This area was marked as an active red zone, and people were forced to cross long distance on foot in order to get their hands on food supplies, especially during the famine spreading period. The way has been very rocky. It's very complicated to get here, and for many Palestinians, they have described these sites to be completely death traps. And according to initial medical reports, we are talking about over 2,600 Palestinians have been killed near the controversial Gaza Humanitarian Foundation aid centers, and over 19,000 others were wounded. This mechanism has been really triggering huge level of criticism among international humanitarian actors, describing it to be very humiliating. And for now, there is a huge shift in the policy of delivering aid supplies, as the United Nations will be responsible in cooperation with the International Committee of the Red Cross to deliver much needed humanitarian supplies during the first phase of the ceasefire deal.
That was Tarek Abu Azoum reporting from central Gaza. We've published many features on the Electronic Intifada in the last week, but we wanted to highlight what I saw from the open hatch of an aid plane over Gaza by an anonymous writer. At 1,000 meters above Gaza, the hatch of a Jordanian aid plane swings open and I get a glimpse of the blue Mediterranean. The shoreline summons images of 1948, when Palestinian families from Haifa and Jaffa were forced to flee to Gaza to escape Zionist militias who were ethnically cleansing Palestine's coastal villages. The images fade quickly from my mind, and they are replaced by today's shoreline. 77 years on, it is again crowded with displaced families and tents. The view of Gaza itself from above is a shock, a disfigured cityscape, where entire neighborhoods have been wiped off the map and others have been reduced to a monotonous gray by Israel's relentless bombardment. Markets barely function, their pale colors set against the rubble, as people walk through ruins or pull carts through broken streets. With every district the plane passes over, the devastation deepens, a relentless panorama of destruction stretching for more than 10 minutes of flight. Weeks earlier, I had been assigned by a news outlet to document these so-called humanitarian operations. I wrestled with the dilemma: should I record a scene I knew to be contrived, or try to show something different? I consulted colleagues, and some urged me to go, suggesting this might be a rare chance to capture what is usually hidden behind the heroic and staged pictures that often emerge from such operations. The trip began at the King Abdullah II Air Base in Zarqa, Jordan, where military aircraft from European countries and, of course, Jordan, are stationed along a lengthy runway. Yet it's the media presence, not the aircraft, that dominates the scene. Dozens of journalists and correspondents compete for interviews and images of the troops as they load aid packages. Every photograph will serve a pivotal purpose: to polish the images of the states involved in the airdrops and to legitimize the aid operation itself. As the plane prepared for takeoff, a question troubled me. How will we prove 30 years from now, in the pages of history, that these images were never about aid? The very states that now posture in sympathy to Palestinians, appearing to send relief, are the same ones that have armed Israel politically and militarily. They have granted Israel cover to wage a war of annihilation on Gaza. Today's airdrops are attempts to cleanse blood-stained hands, yet they ignore calls from Palestinians in Gaza themselves to end this theater. As the photographers and journalists boarded the plane, we were instructed by military personnel not to film Gaza or its devastation. On the flight I joined, filming was restricted to the boxes of supplies and the soldiers. On board, the handful of journalists were monitored by military media officers who combed through images to ensure lenses did not point toward Gaza's annihilation, but remained fixed on the spectacle of aid. Once again, the Palestinian voice was erased mid-flight. And of course, most journalists and outlets don't care. So long as the footage is exclusive and can be sold, nothing else matters. The aid drop journey took nearly 2 hours round trip. Once the aircraft door was shut, with all the packages dropped onto Gaza, the atmosphere inside grew quiet and cameras stopped recording. Through the window, the coastline came back into view. The soldiers began to look like actors on a break between takes, stretched out on the floor, waiting for the plane to return to the military airport. If the ceasefire holds, airdrops may become outmoded as a form of whitewashing for governments complicit in the genocide. But those same countries will still pose as Gaza's saviors, promising aid that will come with many colonial strings attached. Back in Amman, as I headed back into the city, I saw the banners for the Jordan International Food Festival, hosted by the Jordanian government, while Gaza starves. Those are excerpts from What I Saw from the Open Hatch of an Aid Plane Over Gaza by an anonymous writer on electronicintifada.net. And now, as we always do, we wanted to highlight people expressing joy, determination, and resilience across Gaza and around the world. In Gaza, a freed Palestinian hostage is carried on the shoulders of his community, still in Israeli prison garb, but singing and dancing. This clip was filmed by reporter Rami Salim. And finally, music teacher Ahmad Muin Abu Amsha and his colleagues performed a song by the legendary Lebanese artist Marcel Khalifa called The Child and the Plane. He said this performance of the song was inspired by Manal Awad, the director of the Edward Said National Conservatory of Music's Gaza branch. The song, Abu Amsha writes, is about a little boy who searches for strings to fly his kite, a symbol of joy, innocence, and freedom. But the sky betrayed his dream. The plane he saw was larger than life and heavier than his tiny heart. It came not with peace, but with destruction. We sing The Child and the Plane by Marcel Khalifa with the displaced children in Gaza's camps to remind the world that childhood deserves peace.
1, 2, 3, 4.
And that's it for the news roundup. As always, go to electronicintifada.net for much more, especially to read our new features by our brave writers in Gaza. You've been listening to the Electronic Intifada's newscast. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. Want to hear more? Check out our live stream with interviews, reports, and analysis, along with print articles, podcasts, and more at electronicintifada.net. Produced by Nora Barrows-Friedman, Tamara Nassar, and Pierre Loisel.
You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. The latest ceasefire in Gaza, brokered by the United States, that went into effect on October 10th, did not last long before Israel started targeting and killing Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The same case as with Lebanon, where Israel has been violating the ceasefire agreement with Lebanon thousands of times over the past few months, with ongoing bombing and destruction of areas in Lebanon. The word ceasefire for apartheid Israel has always meant the other side ceases and we fire. Of course, the so-called mainstream media or corporate media never reports on Israeli violations of ceasefire agreements, but rush and make it breaking news when the other side fires or breaks the ceasefire. And let's make no mistake about this latest so-called peace plan by President Trump. Just like ceasefire, meaning the other side ceases and Israel fires, peace to the West, including the United States and apartheid Israel, means the other side surrenders, bows, and accepts whatever is forced onto it, while Israel dictates whatever terms and actions it wants to do. That's what they mean by peace. On October 11, 2025, an estimated 600,000 people attended the National March for Palestine event held in London, organized by the Palestine Solidarity Campaign in the UK, to show their support for freedom and justice for Palestine. I'm going to share with you some of the remarks delivered at that event, and let's begin with portions of the speech delivered by Bin Jamal, director of Palestine Solidarity Campaign.
Friends, I want to thank each and every one of you who has been marching for 2 years and who came again today 600,000 strong. Now I have been asked by virtually every journalist who has interviewed me over the past 2 days, now there is a ceasefire. Why do you still feel the need to protest? Why are you all not going back to your home? So let's remember why. Let us remember what we said at the start of this rally, that we came, first of all, to mourn with the Palestinian people 2 years of a genocide that has killed, slaughtered, over 67,000 leaving uncounted thousands under the rubble, destroyed all of the infrastructure of life in Gaza, left not a hospital fully functioning, and left hundreds of thousands still facing death by famine. We came as well, yes, to share the relief and, yes, joy of the Palestinian people that a ceasefire has been declared. We know why people were dancing 2 days ago on the streets of Khan Yunis. Today, maybe, Palestinian parents might feel able not to have to once more write the names of their children upon their children's arms, so that if they are blown to bits, some part of them might be recognizable for burial. Today, I am remembering the words of Atef Abu Said, who on January the 19th of this year, the day the last ceasefire was declared, wrote this: "The dream of each person who died has been to hear this announcement. Lucky the man or woman who got to hear it. Lucky the child or adult who can start to think of making their way back to the pile of rubble that is their home. Lucky are those who will have time to breathe and think of tomorrow and maybe the day after. But today, friends, we also share the trepidation of the Palestinian people that this ceasefire will not hold, a trepidation rooted in the knowledge that Israel has violated every ceasefire agreement it has ever signed and been enabled to do so by Western governments, including our own. But today, most of all, whilst we welcome the fact that the bombs are for now not falling on Gaza and aid may soon be delivered to prevent death by starvation, we know that Donald Trump's plan is not a pathway to an enduring peace, because it does not address the root causes of the violence. It has nothing to say about the killing, the displacement, the ethnic cleansing and the destruction that is continuing today in the West Bank. It has nothing to say about what is required to end the military occupation. It has nothing to say about what is required to dismantle the structure of apartheid that exists across all of historic Palestine. And not a word to say about what is required to enable the majority of the Palestinian people, including every single member of my Palestinian family, to return from exile to the homes from which their families were expelled in 1948. We know what this plan is. It is a plan to normalize Israel's ongoing crimes, to return to business as usual. But we know this: Israel's system of oppression is built on an ideology, Zionism, that denies rights to Palestinians and ultimately dehumanizes them, an ideology that since 1948 has been made manifest in every law and policy and action that has built and sustains the architecture of apartheid, a structure of racist supremacy that inevitably establishes a racist mindset across a whole society. Remember the opinion polls in June of this year that told us that 82% of Israeli Jews believe still that every Palestinian should be expelled from Gaza, 56% that Israel should expel every Palestinian citizen of Israel, and that 47% believe that Israel has the right to slaughter every Palestinian living in the towns and cities that it occupies. So, friends, that is why the Israeli government feels so comfortable inviting Tommy Robinson to Israel, because they know that someone with his racist, anti-Palestinian, Islamophobic views will be widely welcomed, as he has been on many pro-Israel demonstrations across this country. So our task now is simple and is what it has always been, that we do not allow this normalization of Israel's crimes to happen. Understand this. Netanyahu's plan was to drive every Palestinian from Gaza and to colonize that land. He has only been prevented by the refusal of the Palestinian people to submit and by the pressure of this global movement that has led to Israel being more isolated than at any time in its history. Donald Trump, for once, told the truth when he told Netanyahu, you have to stop, you cannot fight the entire world. So today, we reassert our demand for an end to the complicity of our government, our public bodies, our companies, our corporations with Israel's ongoing system of racist oppression.
That was Ben Jamal, director of Palestine Solidarity Campaign, speaking at the National March for Palestine held in London on October 11, 2025. Jeremy Corbyn, member of the British Parliament, also spoke at that event. Let's take a listen.
Thank you all for being here today on our 32nd national demonstration. And I think we should thank all the organizations, Friends of Alexa, Stop the War, Palestine Solidarity, CND, and everybody else for being here today, and all those volunteers that do so much work, stewarding, leafleting, and everything else. We are all, to misquote David Cameron, in it together for peace for Palestine. I received a message this morning from my good friend, Dr. Mustafa Barghouti, who says this: despite declaring the ceasefire in Gaza, the Israeli army killed 17 Palestinian civilians and injured 71 in the last 24 hours. He then goes on to say, and listen to this very carefully, according to civil defense in Gaza, 100 bodies of civilian Palestinians were recovered from under the rubble with signs that they were field executed by the Israeli army. And he goes on to say that there are, at the moment, an estimated 10,000 bodies still under the rubble, on top of the 67,000 we already know that have died. We also know that this peace agreement has not brought peace, and I don't believe can bring long-term peace. Much more needs to be done. Because 55% of Gaza at the moment is still under Israeli control. They have not withdrawn from Gaza, and it's going to take an awful lot more effort to make them fully withdraw. The only way there's going to be a permanent long-term peace is when Israel is forced to withdraw from Gaza and the West Bank and end the settlement policy and give the right of return to those hundreds of thousands living in refugee camps who have been there and their ancestors before them since 1948. And in the reckoning that we're now putting on all of this, the increasing political isolation of Israel and the USA in world opinion hasn't happened by accident. It's the hundreds of thousands of us here today on the streets of London. It's those who've marched in Paris, Berlin, New York, Washington, Cape Town, Buenos Aires, Melbourne, Sydney, every city all around the world. It's this global movement. It's this global movement that has made an enormous difference. And when we've had our Gaza tribunal, we exposed
the role of the Israeli army and of the British army in supplying weapons to Israel, and the use of Royal Air Force bases in supplying weapons. And so there's a reckoning to come. It's not just the ICC and the ICJ, it's a reckoning for all those politicians that propped up the Israeli war machine, that provided the political cover and the support for them. And so those that have acted in solidarity can hold their heads up high. Those that went on the flotilla, bless you all and hold your heads up high for all that you did. And for the solution to be permanent, for there to be permanent peace, you won't get it with a colonial style meeting around a table in the White House or anywhere else. And you certainly won't get it from Viceroy Tony Blair stepping ashore in Gaza to take over the governorship of Gaza. The only people that should govern Gaza, the only people that should govern the West Bank, are the Palestinian people. And we will be here as often and as long as it takes until the war is over and every Palestinian child can go to school, get fed, get medicine when they need it, and lead the life that we want every child everywhere in the world to lead. The war will only be over when that has been achieved. Thank you for all your solidarity. Thank you for all your work. And we will carry on as long as it takes. Thank you.
That was Jeremy Corbyn, member of the British Parliament. Denise Goff, an Irish actress who visited the occupied West Bank recently, also spoke at the National March for Palestine held in London about what she witnessed there.
A ceasefire is not liberation. A ceasefire is not an end to the decades-long occupation. I recently came back from the West Bank, an immense privilege for me, a white woman, to be able to visit when so many Palestinian people themselves cannot. I don't think anything could have prepared me for what I witnessed there. I spent time with one of the many farmers who now lives in a home under siege, surrounded by fences on land that belonged to his forefathers, now stolen. I listened to him talk while his children poured coffee. The same children who mustn't make too much noise, or the settlers next door will come onto their balconies and point guns at them, strip naked and taunt them until the children are forced back indoors to a house that is under constant surveillance. I met a young woman who went to prison as a child for standing up to the soldier who shot her cousin in the head in front of her. We walked through the village of Liftah, ethnically cleansed in 1948. The remains are continually desecrated by settlers who now use the once beautiful family homes as toilets. A now destroyed mosque serves as a party location for settlers who daub the walls in racist graffiti. All of this supported by the occupying army. I don't have enough time to tell you today about everything, to talk about Hebron, Masafa Yatta, the Aida camp, Shafat. But what I can say is that the cruelty of Israel and the Zionist entity is something I will never, ever forget. The considered and meticulous ways in which it is meted out is breathtaking. The subjugation, humiliation, and disrespect that the Palestinian people are expected to withstand are nothing we would ever accept for ourselves. And there is no doubt that the seeds of what has been done in Gaza are being planted in the West Bank as we speak, and have been for many, many years. For decades, Palestinian people have told us what has been happening, and so many of us, myself included, were distracted, gaslighted by an entity that has friends everywhere. But now we are awake, and we will remain awake. To those seeking hope, it is hard to find, but I found it in the Palestinian people themselves. This is the overriding memory I choose to take from my time there. The word Sumud means steadfastness. The people of Palestine embody this word, but we know that they are exhausted. To be abandoned by governments all over the world for decades takes a huge toll. To live under constant attack is soul-destroying. And yet, they gather, they resist, they love, they play, they dance, they fight, they rage, they laugh, they cry, they rebuild. They are the example to the world of what it is to be truly human. I believe we understand what our responsibility is now. We will embody the word Samud in ourselves. We are not saving the Palestinian people, we are saving ourselves. We are saving ourselves from systems that are depraved, that flourish when we stand by and allow the abuse and subjugation of others. By taking the opportunity to stand up and fight for real change in a world that is built to distract us and reward us for our silence, we can regain and retain our humanity. I will be forever grateful to the people of Palestine, and I know that we will never stop in any effort we can make to ensure a future which sees true freedom and liberation for all Palestinian people everywhere. By being here today, we are saying we will continue to do everything we can, wherever we are, to end the occupation of Palestine. In our thousands, in our millions, we are all Palestinians. Thank you so much.
That was Denise Goff, an Irish actress, speaking at the National March for Palestine held in London on October 11, 2025, attended by an estimated 600,000 people. You're listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. On October 6, 2025, the United Nations Security Council held an open debate on women, peace, and security. Professor Noura Ariqat, a Palestinian-American human rights attorney and author, spoke at that event on how Israel's ongoing Nakba in Gaza intends to destroy the Palestinian people in violation of the Genocide Convention, and she detailed in her talk how attacks on the reproductive capacity of Palestinian women and girls collectively aim to eliminate the possibility of a Palestinian future in four stages. Let's listen in.
President, Excellencies, thank you for the opportunity to brief you today. I'm Noura Ariqat, a Palestinian-American human rights attorney and author. 25 years ago, when this body adopted Resolution 1325, the Security Council made an unabashedly feminist commitment to advance gender equality because you understood that women are critical agents for a just peace. Nowhere is this more apparent than in Palestine, where for decades, courageous Palestinian women have resisted dispossession, removal, apartheid, and now genocide. Yet nowhere have the WPS agenda's tenets of equality, inclusivity, accountability, and respect for human rights been more out of reach. In Gaza, one woman and one girl have been killed every hour for the past 730 days. Despite the recent enthusiasm to end this war, the terms of the current proposal are setting up Palestinians to live under permanent occupation and siege. The end of this genocide cannot come at the expense of accountability and justice for its survivors. The voices of Palestinian women have been notably absent from this chamber. I am here today because my Palestinian sisters cannot be. Those who are able to travel outside the besieged Bantustans Israel has created across Palestine are denied visas to the United States. Others face reprisals for speaking out. This council should be doing everything in its power to recognize and support Palestinian women as agents of change. But when a people are enduring genocide, the first priority is life. Today, I will show how Israel's ongoing Nakba in Gaza intends to destroy the Palestinian people in violation of the Genocide Convention. I will detail how attacks on the reproductive capacity of Palestinian women and girls collectively aim to eliminate the possibility of a Palestinian future in four stages. One, it is a struggle for Palestinians to survive, let alone conceive in Gaza. 92% of residential buildings have been destroyed, leaving no quarter for privacy or intimacy. Further, the systematic sexual abuse and torture of Palestinians in captivity, including rape of men, women, and children, filmed forced nudity, electrocution of genitalia, have resulted in mental and physical trauma that impede an ability to engage in sexual intimacy at all. Recently, the UN Commission of Inquiry concluded that the bombing of the Al Basma Fertility Clinic that destroyed 4,000 embryos and over 1,000 vials of sperm and unfertilized eggs was a measure intended to prevent births. Between 2022 and 2025, the birth rate of Palestinians in Gaza has declined by 41%. Two, even if Palestinian women manage to conceive, it is a struggle to carry life to full gestation. In addition to the trauma of incessant bombardment, attacks on medical facilities, hunger, and disease, it is impossible for women to meet basic needs, let alone access their sexual and reproductive rights. Shema Jabir Thabit became pregnant with her first child during the genocide. On the day her shelter was bombed in Nusayrat, Shema described how she fled by foot without destination, how she saw women fainting from shock and children screaming in fear, how she felt it was truly a day of judgment. A week later, doctors told her that her baby would not survive. By 2024, the rate of miscarriage in Gaza has increased by 300%. Three, even if Palestinian women manage to carry life, it is a struggle to deliver. As of August, some 55,000 Palestinian women lack access to prenatal care, increasing the risk of postpartum hemorrhage, the leading cause of maternal death. Maha went into labor in Rafah. The city, originally home to 300,000 people, was sheltering 1.5 million. She was turned away from the hospital due to capacity constraints and forced to deliver in a public bathroom. Maha is not an exception. Every week, at least 15 women in Gaza deliver in appalling conditions. And those that do reach a hospital do not fare much better, like Shema Iftouh, who endured a C-section without anesthesia. She described the pain as beyond human tolerance. Four, even if women and their babies survive, it is a struggle to keep Palestinian newborns alive. Famine has been confirmed in Gaza. Over 60% of pregnant and breastfeeding women are unable to produce milk due to malnutrition. As these women starve, they grow faint with anemia, their teeth may fall out, and their immune systems, already weakened by pregnancy, become even more vulnerable to disease. Many will give weight to underweight babies, birth to underweight babies. Amita's parents were able to feed her until she was 6 months old. But when she caught an infectious disease, her parents could do nothing but watch her die. Amita is among at least 450 babies that were born and killed during the genocide. Taking together these four stages of attack on survival and intimacy, pregnancy and gestation, labor and delivery, and child rearing and parenting show the intensity of attack on the ability of Palestinians in Gaza to reproduce and continue life. This was always the intention. In May 2025, Zahut party leader and former member of the Knesset, Moshe Feiglin, said, "Every child in Gaza is the enemy. We need to occupy Gaza and settle it, and not a single Gazan child will be left there." He was not prosecuted for incitement to genocide. Despite an ICC arrest warrant, Foreign Defense Minister Yoav Gallant, who referred to all Palestinians as human animals, remains at large. Just 2 days after the UN Commission of Inquiry concluded that Israel is committing genocide in Gaza, the United States cast its sixth veto of a Security Council ceasefire resolution and now advances plans to absolve alleged war criminals, to whitewash a genocide we have all witnessed, and to render once again Palestinian self-determination into a question at the mercy of outsiders. As enshrined in the UN Charter, our inalienable rights cannot be subject to negotiation. Palestinians have a right to self-determination in our ancestral homeland, a homeland that has etched the shape and color of our embroidered dresses, that has entwined our family lineages through marriage, that has flavored our most exquisite dishes with the bite of pomegranate molasses and the tang of green olives harvested in the fall. A homeland that has provided grammar for our poetry and holy sites for our worship and pilgrimage. Our survival cannot be conditioned on surrendering our right to build a collective future on this land which makes life worth living. And our refusal to surrender is precisely why this campaign aims to destroy the Palestinian people. In its current form, the U.S. proposal is contingent on the removal of Palestinians from the helm of their political future. As emphasized by UN experts on Friday, the political outcome that we also desperately want cannot be based on outright violations of international law. Excellencies, you cannot allow brute power to unravel our humanity. I therefore urge you to insist that any solution to end the genocide not come at the expense of accountability or respect for international law. To ensure, as stipulated by the ICJ, that the end of occupation is overseen by the UN, not Israel and its allies. To protect the integrity of ongoing proceedings at the ICJ and the ICC. To end the transfer of arms and other equipment or items, including jet fuel, to Israel. To pursue prosecution of individuals, corporations, and media companies complicit in genocide. And to ensure that Palestinian women can meaningfully participate in rebuilding their societies and ultimately forging our collective futures. Should you be paralyzed by fear, I encourage you to look to Palestinian women. They refuse to surrender. Neither should you. Thank you.
That was Professor Noura Arikat, a Palestinian-American human rights attorney and author, speaking at the UN Security Council's open debate on women, peace, and security held on October 6, 2025. You've been listening to Arab Voices, a syndicated radio talk show on dozens of radio stations in the US and Europe since 2002. Our shows are archived online, and you can listen to them by visiting arabvoices.net. And that does it for the show today. Thanks for listening. This is Saeed, executive producer and host of Arab Voices. Until we meet next week, peace on earth.